This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on December 10th. Thanks for the handoff, Rocky. In a 2015 opinion piece in the New York Times titled When Americans Lynched Mexicans, authors William Kerrigan and Clive Webb observed that coverage of mob violence has largely focused on lynchings of African Americans. Indeed, they point out that few groups have suffered more systematic mistreatment, abuse, and murder than blacks. Nevertheless, other racial and ethnic minorities have been targeted, including Native Americans, Italians, Chinese, and especially Mexicans. The authors report that between 1848 and 1928, thousands of Mexicans were murdered by mobs, although surviving records can document less than 600. And while most took place in states along the U.S. southern border, they also occurred elsewhere, as far away as Wyoming, for example. Despite similarities between lynchings of blacks and lynchings of Mexicans, they point out that local authorities and deputized citizens, quote, played particularly conspicuous roles in mob violence against Mexicans, unquote. From 1915 to 1918, law officials, including the Texas Rangers, executed without due process thousands of Mexicans for their alleged role in a revolutionary uprising known as the Plan de San Diego. Kerrigan and Webb conclude by observing similarities with the present-day racial environment in the U.S. Quote, in today's charged debate over immigration policy and the growth of the Latino population, the history of anti-Mexican violence reminds us of the costs and consequences of hate. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guests this evening are Benjamin Johnson from Loyola University of Chicago and John Moran Gonzalez from UT Austin. Both are founders of Refusing to Forget, an award-winning educational nonprofit that works to increase public awareness of an often forgotten period in the history of the United States about 100 years ago. Refusing to Forget seeks to raise the profile of a struggle for justice and civil rights that continues to influence social relationships today. We are joined by Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project, and Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of the show. Welcome to all of you, and thanks so much for joining us. Ben and John, could you tell us a little about yourselves first?
Yeah, so I'm Ben Johnson. I teach in the Department of History at Loyola University Chicago. I grew up in Houston, taught for 9 years at SMU, regularly teaching Texas history classes, and I'm the author of Revolution in Texas, a book that examines racial violence and Mexican-American civil rights politics in early 20th century Texas.
And I'm John Moran Gonzalez. I teach in the English department at the University of Texas at Austin, where I'm J. Frank Dobie Regents Professor of American and English Literature. I teach courses in Latinx studies, particularly in Latinx literature. I'm former director of the Center for Mexican American Studies, and the book I'll mention is Border Renaissance, the Texas Centennial, and the Emergence of Mexican American Literature, which takes a look at how Mexican American authors responded to a key moment in 1936.
Could you tell us a little about this organization, first of all, Refusing to Forget?
So we are about bringing to light and public awareness knowledge of some really horrific racial violence perpetrated against Mexican descent people, especially in Texas in the 19-teens. And we formed out of discussions between me and John and four other scholars who studied these events, when we just kind of kept exchanging our frustrations that although they were very well known to some of the descendants of people involved, and they were very well known to specialists on the region and on Mexican American history and Mexican American studies, they really hadn't penetrated into popular consciousness, despite the fact that, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people were killed and it had enduring consequences for Texas. So we shared our frustrations. And then in about 2013 or so, we realized that the 100-year anniversary of a lot of these events were coming up. And we wondered if maybe that was a chance to change that.
And John, tell us a little more about what you're trying to accomplish with this. When did you form the organization, by the way?
Well, we started discussions in 2013, but really came together at a NOCS, National Association of Chicano and Chicana Studies, regional conference in Texas in 2014. And as Ben mentioned, it really was about kind of raising public awareness of these events, particularly in the context of a contemporary events. As you may recall, that is the era of cases of racial violence, Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown, Sandra Bland. I mean, these cases of state racial violence against communities of color reverberated for us with what happened 100 years ago. And so we wanted to bring them back to public consciousness as part of the discussion around these issues. And I will just add, I'm a native of the Rio Grande Valley, where much of this violence took place 100 plus years ago, and I did not learn about this until graduate school. The question of why I didn't know about it, despite its incredible importance for the history of the region, was central for me in joining the group.
Uh-huh.
I think we all had versions of that experience. You know, I guess some of us knew about this through family stories, right? Some of our collaborators, but for people like me and John, it was a similar experience. I was in my 20s. I had a BA in history. I had gone through Texas schools. I had taken seventh grade Texas history. My parents had done the same thing. And I'm living in New England in history graduate school, you know, in my mid-20s. And I'm only now finding out about this. And it just seemed like totally wrong, right? I wanted to know about it. And I also wanted to know like the backstory about why I didn't know about these things, why I knew more about, you know, New York City and the Civil War or Chicago in the 19-teens than I did about the very state that I was from and was studying.
And Jim, when you were at Texas Civil Rights Project, you guys established an office in El Paso. When did you first become aware of, for example, La Matanza?
It's really pretty interesting. So I worked in the valley down in San Juan for 10 years. With farm workers. And there was actually, with the older folks, you could pick up stories, not with a lot of detail, that there was kind of a memory going on. In fact, there was a corrido or two that were popular from time to time. And that was particularly about the violence of the Texas Rangers against people in South Texas. So we have an office there. And then we later established one in El Paso. And it was the same thing. And this is unfortunate because this is sort of what I'm hearing. In the younger generations, nothing. But in the older folks, I mean, there wasn't a lot of particularity, but there was a lot of understanding that some really bad stuff had happened that had caused a lot of people to be killed. And one of the things often that would come up was how the Rangers would shoot people in the back, you know, would be chasing them for whatever reason, or just show up and kill people. So I'm really glad to hear about this because I know that in the people's minds, the older folks, there was stuff that went on. This is really going to fill it in for people and really going to fill it in for the younger generation and give a lot of context to why the Mexican-American community is where it is today.
Well, let's go ahead and fill it in for folks. Could one of you start to outline a little about the history of the early 20th century in the Rio Grande Valley in West Texas? This is all on the heels of the Mexican Revolution, right?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of key contextual events. You know, the first one is more about the relationship between the border regions of Texas and the rest of the United States. And that is that in the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th century, for the first time, they're actually really much more fundamentally integrated with the rest of the country. So especially through railroad connections, right? So if you think about the Valley now, you know, I grew up visiting from Houston, thinking about it in terms of agriculture, right? And citriculture, right? Especially citrus groves. Well, until the railroad came in 1905, it's still mostly a ranching place, right? You didn't have that kind of agriculture. So there's a railroad connection. And for the first time, about half the population are actually Anglo, right? And then some of them are moving from the rest of Texas in the South, but most of them are actually coming from the Midwest, the key American agricultural region. And they come into a place that has been actually, you know, majority Mexican descent since its incorporation into the United States at the end of the U.S.-Mexico War in 1848. But they have to deal with a population that, you know, essentially a native, you know, Mexican descent population that still includes landowners, where Mexican descent people still vote, where they serve as local office holders, where they often serve in positions of law enforcement. But a lot of them don't like that, right? They're not equipped as Americans. This is not like Iowa, right? Or this is not like East Texas, where in the previous decade, you know, Black voting has essentially been eliminated and the Jim Crow system has been put into place. And so a lot of them start saying, hey, you know, we don't want these people voting, right? We don't want these people serving on juries. This is not the way the United States is supposed to work. So that's one of the key contexts, right? And so a lot of Mexican descent people who had owned land, you know, are losing their land. So that's one context. The other context is the Mexican Revolution, right? Which breaks out in 1911, in which, you know, basically most of the Mexican population had lost access to independent land ownership and was starting to become wage laborers on really unequal terms. And there are these popular uprisings that overthrow the oldest regime in the Western Hemisphere. And then by 1915, the revolutionaries, Francisco Villa in the north, Emiliano Zapata in the south, and others are essentially fighting one another for control over Mexico. And so that raises the stakes. It sends a lot of people migrating north to the United States. So it establishes the pattern of migration between Mexico and the United States. That's essentially still in effect today. And it also gives some people in the United States the sense that, you know, maybe some form of revolutionary violence can address the increasingly difficult situation they find themselves in. What else should we add to that, John?
Sure. And the one thing I would add is that really there's this tendency to think, why were Mexican Americans or Mexican descent people in Texas concerned about what's going on in Mexico? Well, I think the answer is that really the incorporation of this region, of the entire border region, but specifically of the lower Rio Grande Valley into the United States was a very late occurring kind of event. As late as 1904, there was no railroad to this region. And so really the folks of the valley were plugged into Mexico economically, socially, and politically. And you have to remember, people paid their taxes in dollars, but pesos were common currency. English was the official language of governance, but everybody spoke Spanish. And when you spoke of the capital, you were really talking about the DF, not DC. I mean, that was the orientation of the valley and of the border. And so they very much were involved in the revolution and were participants in the revolution in very meaningful ways. And so I think this is part of the context, in addition to the changes that Ben mentioned. Hmm.
And so did some sort of a rift then develop between those who identified with the U.S. and those who identified with Mexico? Was that the source of the conflict?
Yeah, you see increasing estrangement and increasing violence, actually, right? Even before the Mexican Revolution, that becomes a way to take people's land and a way to assert white power in a region where, as John points out, it was really tenuous, right? And where even like white newcomers would often marry into Tejano or Mexican American families, where some of them would convert to Catholicism, right? At a time when that was, you know, mildly scandalous in Protestant circles, where they would actually learn to speak English. But there's a couple of, you know, kind of classic cases of violent frays, especially between white law enforcement officials and the Texas Rangers, and increasing economic change, right? And especially land loss, which was one of the things that I looked at in my book.
I was talking about people I had spoken with when I was working in the Valley, and people would talk. They still had family histories of how their property was stolen from them, how the Anglo community would just walk in, fence it off, and be supported by the Rangers and local law enforcement, which at that time became controlled by the Anglo establishment. It was really interesting to talk, and, you know, people would say, well, that was my land over there. You know, they just stole it from me. Benson was famous for that, you know, who moved into that area and set up Citrus. And I remember one time talking to this old troquero from Harlingen. And I don't know if this is true or he's confusing it, but he said that Pancho Villa, for example, had come across the border into Harlingen. I would suspect that it was probably not Pancho Villa, but, you know, that that fight came over onto our side. And the same thing up in El Paso, that it leached over. And a lot of it, to me, you know, also represents the fakeness of the border. Hmm. You know, that it was very arbitrary because that was Mexico, you know. And even after it became part of the U.S., people just went back and forth all the time. There was really no actual boundary in the sense that there is today.
I was just going to say that as far as my family is concerned, you know, I'm a white. And my family also has history with the Texas Rangers. I grew up like you, Ben. I went to Texas schools and learned Texas history and never learned any of this. My grandmother is still alive. She's 100 years old. She was born and raised in New Mexico. And her family has history with the Texas Rangers because she has uncles who were part of the Texas Rangers. And so I grew up with stories of the heroism and all that. So all the whitewashing, the legacy of the Texas Rangers. Our family also has, my grandmother has stories about her uncles talking about Pancho Villa and being in the Texas Rangers. So it's interesting for me to listen to all this. And when I heard about all this a couple of years ago for the first time and started bringing that up with my grandmother, you know, it was like, what is the history of our family? What is true? What is not true? What is kind of like the lore versus what is real?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of these oral histories and memories, like, they're often wrong in their particulars, right? So I've heard a lot of people, both Anglo and Mexican in the Valley, say that Pancho Villa attacked American cities in the Valley, which is just not true. What is true about that is the sense in which the larger course of the Mexican Revolution was bound up in these events. And then, you know, Jim, the stories about land loss are certainly almost certainly true, right? Both direct acts of violence. So I was shocked. One of the first documents I read when I was doing this research was Lon Hill, who was a prominent landowner and agricultural developer, you know, and there's a lot of things named after Lon Hill and his son, Lon Hill Jr., in the Valley today. He just says in court, I mean, he says this in sworn testimony in court in a, you know, lawsuit over land dispute. He says, I went to this guy, Barrera, and told him to pack up his doll rags and on the fire and never come back to this land and that this land was mine now. So the fact both that he did that, but that he could say that in court without any sense that there would be consequences for it was really chilling. You know, there's also an economic factor to this, right? So all of a sudden, when you have a railroad connection, land in the Valley like starts to be worth more, right? You know, you can get more from selling it, which you think would be a good thing, right? But it's kind of like gentrification. It then means that your property taxes go way up. If you're not involved in a commercial economy much, you don't have a lot of cash, right? Because you mostly live off the land and grow and raise the things that you need. So your land becomes tax delinquent. A lot of times this was announced, you know, in legal notices that were only printed in English, right? You have to hire an attorney to deal with these things. The attorneys are almost certainly Anglos from the outside. A lot of the attorneys somehow ended up with a lot of the land, and you're forced to sell the land that you have to raise the money. So there's both like outright violence that's happening increasingly in the first decade of the 20th century that accounts for land loss, but there are also these kind of economic factors that account for people losing their land. And that was so similar to what was going on in Mexico, right? Which is another reason why the Mexican Revolution seems so relevant. It wasn't just that they were plugged into Mexico, it was essentially that the same kind of thing was happening.
I'll also just add a little bit more on the economic aspect. You have to remember, this was really ranching land, and it was ranching land because it is semi-desert, right? That is, you know, there's not enough rainfall for agriculture. And so one of the huge capital investments in order to turn the valley into an agricultural environment was massive water infrastructure investments. Of course, this is facilitated by the state, which has to pass the legislation forming water districts, water infrastructure, irrigation, canals, pumping stations, all of that is also extremely crucial to this story.
You mentioned the government here. You mentioned Texas Rangers. It's come up several times here. I'm just wondering, has anyone investigated how organized this was? I mean, was this all just grassroots, or was there something going on in upper reaches of government here?
I mean, there's no like centralized giant conspiracy, right, to like take over the valley. But the people who are benefiting from this and driving the process are closely tied in with Texas power structures. And they're certainly able to call on the state government and especially the Ranger Force as a kind of paramilitary when there's resistance to that. So what happens is that there's an effort in the middle of 1915 to kind of create an uprising, right, against these forces of land loss and dispossession. There's a manifesto issue called the Plan of San Diego that calls for a revolt and the possibility of returning the area to Mexico. First, nothing much happens, and then there are a few attacks on irrigation works and some prominent landowners, and that's where things really kick into high gear, right? And the mechanisms of both vigilante violence by local Anglos and some sheriffs and attorneys and landowners in South Texas come to the fore, but that's also especially where the Rangers come in a very organized way and start, in some places, pretty much indiscriminately killing Mexican descent people, right? Or arresting someone. You know, in one case, they grab someone off a train because he fits the description of someone who was involved in a recent raid, you know, and he's like a 20-year-old Mexican-American guy, and he ends up found dead the next day. And it turns out that, you know, he had the same first name, the person who was named, but had absolutely nothing to do with this. Then it really opens the floodgates, right? If you are, you know, someone who moved there recently and you want more land from Mexican Americans and you've been involved in conflicts with them, then this is a great opportunity for you, right? What you do is you tell the Texas Rangers, hey, this guy's a bandit, right? This guy is a revolutionary. And they go right in and look for him, right? Either to kill him or to arrest him. At one point, Ranger Captain J.M. Fox actually sends in a telegraph back to the Adjutant General, the commander of the Rangers in Austin. He describes riding through like 90 miles of territory, and he says, I ran all the Mexicans off the ranches, right? So once you're getting messages like that, it's clear, even if this wasn't like some well-articulated plan from the beginning, that this is now effectively a kind of state-led effort, right? That this is the kind of combination of private sector vigilantism and state-sanctioned racial violence, and that it's not just targeted at, you know, a few revolutionaries, right, or a few people who might be resisting this process with armed force. At this point, it's targeted at, you know, pretty much the entire Mexican descent community.
Following up on the railroad, how it fits into this context is that it became the instrument of segregation. Mexican community on one side, Anglo community on the other side, and it was written into law. And I think even culturally, what's really sort of disgusting about this whole thing is the renaming of the cities, you know, renaming of the cities with Anglo names, sometimes like West Local connected to a land company or ELSA, you know, all that kind of stuff that sort of worked at deculturizing the Mexican community and creating that version of apartheid that emerges in the valley.
And just to reemphasize what's been said, really, it was this combination of kind of mob violence, vigilantism, along with state violence, right, by law enforcement, that really made this possible. This kind of segregation could only be made possible by the use of deadly violence and the denial of due process at a mass scale. Not only were Mexican folks just outright murdered by the Rangers, say, but in other instances, they were tortured or otherwise driven off the land. I think the lesson for us today is that there's this incident where there was this massive denial of due process at every level, and that it was state sanctioned, if not state led, and that the kind of question of descendants and other people seeking justice for this collective punishment of a population is ongoing today.
Just to add some kind of concrete examples, I mean, I think these two comments are absolutely right. And Jim is right to point to the emergence of segregation as one of the outcomes of this, right? So that you get a social system that's modeled after the Jim Crow system of the South. So a few examples of that are, in the years after 1915, Rangers are deployed to voting stations after they've killed hundreds of people. And so the Mexican descent vote like plummets dramatically. So even without a legal disenfranchisement, there is effective disenfranchisement. One of the attorneys, who's actually an Anglo guy, who's representing some of the slain, is pistol whipped openly in the court hallway by a Texas Ranger captain, right, who's never charged with this. So the sense is they're trying to not only intimidate Mexican descent people, but, you know, anyone in the white community who's going to stand up and speak against this is, you know, is exposed to personal violence too. And then one of the most consequential killings is a double murder in 1916 of Jesus Bazan and Antonio Longoria, who were, you know, a father-in-law and son in this family in Hidalgo County. And they had held high office. One of them had been a deputy sheriff. They were landowners. They were widely known and respected. And they're just shot, you know, on the side of a road, and their bodies are left out because their families are afraid to go bury them. And that sends a message to everybody that it doesn't matter who you are, right, or what you've done or what your politics are, that you're vulnerable to execution on site, and that we're certainly not going to let you be a deputy sheriff or serve on a jury or anything like that.
We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on December 10th. Our guests this evening are Benjamin Johnson and John Moran Gonzalez, both from the organization Refusing to Forget. Let's pick up where we left off.
The one incident that people do seem to be hearing about these days is Porvenir. Could one of you speak to the specifics of what happened there?
So yeah, it's the worst single incident, right? And it happens in 1918. It's out in West Texas in Presidio County. And there is a small but proud and independent, you know, Mexican farming ranching community in Porvenir, Texas, which hauntingly enough means future, right? So that which is to come. And there had been a raid on a local ranch, the Bright Ranch, previously. So that raid happens in late 1917. And then it's a little mysterious how this gets put into action, but there's a company of Texas Rangers, which has been stationed in the valley and had been commanded by someone who had overseen many of these killings and this kind of ethnic cleansing and dispossession of Mexican descent people. He's sent out there. And so a ranger company, in conjunction with one unit of U.S. cavalry, comes into this village in January of 1918, separates a group of 15 men and boys, right, some of whom are teenagers, from the rest of the village. And they are lined up against a bank and shot. and their bodies left out. So it's the largest single event of mass killing that we have from these events. And it was the one at the time that caused the most notoriety and particularly led to J.T. Canales, who was the only Mexican descent person, so the only non-Anglo-American in the state legislature at that time, to break with the Rangers. He had been working behind the scenes in South Texas, in the valley where he's from, to try to prevent the worst of these atrocities, and had even been basically getting U.S. Army units to deploy in Mexican descent communities to protect them from the Rangers, because in the valley, the Army was much more even-handed, to the point where actually Army commanders were complaining to the governor and threatening to put South Texas under martial law to restrain the Texas Rangers, because they were so appalled by the conduct and so concerned that it would actually set off, you know, retaliatory violence. So Porvenir is a really kind of a turning point, and Canales files a set of charges then at the end of 1918 against the Rangers. And that sets the stage for a really kind of dramatic hearing and sort of showdown with the Ranger force in January of 1919, which is as close to any kind of accountability or public reckoning that happened either at the time or really, you know, honestly, in the intervening century.
As you mentioned, it sets off the legislative investigation of the Rangers, which has 1,600 pages of eyewitness testimony that covers the Ranger atrocities of the previous decade. And despite all this evidence, there were no indictments, much less convictions, of Rangers. It was common practice for Rangers so accused to simply resign and join some other law enforcement agency, like at the county level, or later the Border Patrol. So essentially, there was a revolving door for law enforcement. They would just shuffle from one agency to another without any consequences. The other point about the Canales investigation is, on one hand, it was a development that groups like the League of United Latin American Citizens would adopt. That is, recourse to the legal system to attempt to enforce Mexican-American civil rights. And this was really the first time the state was forced to reflect upon the actions of its own agents. On the other hand, there was little accountability, or none, I should say. There was a bill passed to reform the Rangers, downsizing them. But really, the signal was one that the Rangers could largely still operate with impunity, and certainly Ranger violence would continue for decades to come.
Speaking of the Ranger violence, you have this farm worker strike in La Casita, 65-67, and incredible brutality by the Texas Rangers. You can tell they knew they could act with impunity. This actually is a case from out of our project at one point. It actually ends up in the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's one of the few times the Supreme Court ever does fact-finding. You know, and if you read that Supreme Court case, Medrano Ali, Ali is the Ranger, the history of brutality, it's just amazing to read that and see that this sort of brutality and viciousness and lack of lawlessness, I mean, this goes all the way up into the 60s. And it was only that case that led to the Texas Rangers being reorganized because it was so bad. And the publicity in the Supreme Court case, you know, finally helped prompt the legislature to do something. I mean, this history comes up into the present time in a way that you just would not expect it to be happening in the United States. I shouldn't say that. That's kind of stupid. This is why you have your project, right? Exactly why you have your project.
Well, you know, I think the absolutely essential to mention that, you know, the Texas Rangers also were hugely involved in the violence against and removal of Native peoples from Texas. And they were slave catchers in the 19th century who would often cross into Mexico in pursuit of folks who sought their freedom. And in the 20th century, they were directly involved in efforts to resist desegregation of schools in East Texas. clearly their mission, as it were, was to uphold white supremacy in these instances. And I don't think there's really any getting around that.
And there's also a class element here too, right? Which I think, you know, Jim's mention of the strike brings out. So in the Canales hearings after poor veneer, you also get a lot of complaints from farmer and labor organizations, even those that are predominantly white, about the use of rangers and the use of state violence to break them up. It's interesting now when we talk about these things, I feel like we talk about them with everybody knowing, or we talk about them kind of under the shadow of the sweeping debates about police violence and violent policing in the United States today. I always sort of thought of this in my mind as a particularly Texas thing, but the events of the last 5 or 6 years have made me realize so many of these issues are basically inherent to policing just across the board in the United States, right? So one of the things Canales wanted to have done is that officers needed to post a bond, right? So that they could be held financially liable if they abused the law. And he wanted people who had been violent to be fired, right? And he wanted them to be criminally prosecuted. And those are exactly the calls today from advocates of police reform and Black Lives Matter, right? Is that we're not going to have equitable and nonviolent policing in the United States until police officers who engage in violence are actually held accountable, both in terms of employment and in terms of the law.
Is it a coincidence that all of this happened about the same time as a severe uptick in anti-Black violence in the U.S., especially immediately post-World War I?
Yeah, no, it's not coincidental at all, right? I mean, that horrific practice of lynching, particularly the kind of public way designed to create a spectacle of dehumanization and humiliation against Black victims, like that's designed to shore up Jim Crow, right? And to keep Black people in a subordinate place. And it's a variation on that theme, right? Or a similar pattern that you see in the borderlands. And there's a similar kind of culture of lynching. And this is what our colleague Monica Martinez talks about in her book, The Injustice Never Leaves You. So this is the era of kind of mass affordable commercial photography, right? So images of victims hung and burned corpses, right? Or in the classic case from South Texas, a set of Texas Rangers on horseback with their lassos around the bodies of men who they have executed without any, you know, even pretense of due process. Those things circulate. So it's all part of a culture and a set of institutions and practices of white supremacy.
I mean, you have to imagine the kind of level of normalized racial violence that, you know, had to be made, had to be established in order for these atrocity postcards of lynchings to be considered acceptable and to circulate in such a fashion. I mean, there was the normalization that an extremely high level of racial violence was simply necessary to sustain and maintain white supremacy.
I read that you have an exhibit at the Bullock Museum. And I would note that earlier this year, a reading of Forget the Alamo was rejected specifically by the lieutenant governor of the state. How is it that your exhibit managed to survive that?
Life and Death on the Border, 1910 to 1920, ran at the Bullock State History Museum in early 2016. It was a special exhibit, short, limited duration. But it was also a deep collaboration between Refusing to Forget and the Bullock Museum, which drew over 40,000 visitors. We felt that it was an important venue in getting this story out into the public eye. It was an incredible success in those terms, as far as the educational mission of RTF, which we've continued through lesson plans for public school teachers, like the one we have on Jovita Hidar, as well as the public education that historical markers also afford, right? Mm-hmm. I like to think of them as vernacular pages of history that are set in aluminum on the side of the road that anybody can read. We have four of those, two in the lower Rio Grande Valley, one in Laredo, and the Porvenir marker out in Presidio County.
But yeah, the exhibit, you know, was really important to us. It was one of the first things that we tried to do, right? We opened up a conversation with Ebola and we worked with them on developing the exhibit. I think two elements of it were especially important. On the one hand, it named names and used words like murder, right? So it showed Texas Rangers, their names, used the word murder and named the names of victims. It included the Canales testimony, which for decades had been suppressed. And I think it's amazing that it actually survived. It also humanized both the individuals who ended up being victimized by the Rangers and the larger community of which they were a part. So it starts off with the kind of history of the settlement of the border region. It had artifacts like wedding dresses and family Bibles. It had portraits of people, right? So that they're not just people who are simply victims, who are simply run over by history. So it ran in a temporary space for 4 months in 2016. Attracted, they told us, 50,000 visitors. It won a national award. Got a lot of press coverage, both in Texas, the U.S., Mexico, and Europe. So we were really pleased that, you know, that they were able to do such a good job with that exhibit.
I'm glad that it survived, at least for those 4 months. I didn't realize it was a temporary exhibit. I suspect, though, it may have gotten onto somebody's radar. And when this Forget the Alamo hit the news, that was just too much for people to take, I suspect.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, we were worried from the beginning that something like that would happen to our exhibit. I even wondered the night before if I was going to drive there in the morning for the opening panel and find that Dan Patrick had gotten wind of this and canceled it. And so that's exactly what I thought of when the state withdrew sponsorship for that event at the Bullock. You know, if we tried to do this today, the Bullock wouldn't be allowed to do this. And I think, like all the efforts to censor teachers, it really puts public servants and professionals, you know, in a terrible bind, right? There's a real integrity on the part of teachers and the kind of people who work at state institutions like the Bullock, right? To present difficult histories, like in a sensitive way that opens up dialogue. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, really having the ground cut out from under them. And I just think it's so chilling to have a state government that's saying, you know, what books are acceptable and what books aren't.
I was curious to know if you guys were planning on anything at a national level, seeing as we've talked about the precedents that this sets for the violence within law enforcement in this country. I would think this would be an important story to get out to the entire country, something like an exhibit at the Smithsonian.
Michelle, I can say that we held in 2019 a major NEH-sponsored conference about the centennial of the Canales hearings at the Bullock State History Museum, which was a fantastic success. And we also thought might be an endpoint for our project. We were thinking, oh, we've done our bit, but careers and families and all other kind of concerns were taking up more time because we really do this in addition to our day job, so to speak. And so we lay fallow for about 18 months. And of course, what happens is the murder of George Floyd, which really convinced us that our potential contributions to a public discussion of these issues wasn't over, and far from it.
I think we've been pleased that although the activities have been based in Texas, that they have received national attention, both from the press, right, which is something we really haven't talked about. But one of our frustrations was that a lot of time the press writes about the border region as though it has no history. And when it writes about things like lynchings, it writes as though they only happened in the Deep South and as though African Americans were the only victims. And so I think we're increasingly seeing that change, right? And we're being approached by filmmakers and by reporters to contextualize, you know, even like anti-Latino violence today, right? Like the horrific shooting in El Paso and the Walmart. But I really share the sense that this is both a kind of nationally a moment of peril, right? With a kind of reaction to the unearthing of histories like this, but also a moment of possibility. And as somebody who grew up in Houston and went to a high school that had, you know, the rebel as the mascot, it's shocking to me how many Confederate monuments have come down and in what prominent places. I mean, if I go back to New Orleans today, I feel like I don't recognize the place, right? Like that was just a fixture of my youth to have those statues up. So on the one hand, I think there is a willingness on the part of so many Americans and so many cultural institutions to consider the histories of violence and race and policing in this country. We've seen real progress, right? I think the fact that the Bullock was willing to do this, the fact that the National Endowment for the Humanities was willing to give us tens of thousands of dollars to put on this conference. And I think that's actually where these anti-teaching measures, the cancellation of the book event at the Alamo come from, right? It's the real sense that actually people growing up in the United States today can be presented with these histories as a part of their cultural inheritance and something that they're going to have to reckon with. You know, I think the people in the legislature who have passed these bills trying to prevent so-called divisive concepts from being taught, their default assumption seems to be that if you leave teachers alone, they're going to expose their students to these difficult histories. And I think they're right. And I think, you know, that's a sign of progress that hopefully these efforts at censorship can't fully erase.
My sense is that, in fact, these are rear guard actions, so to speak, to attempt to prevent a kind of truth and reconciliation around these issues, which definitely begins through education. And I also find it quite ironic that the criteria that is often used in the anti-critical race theory kind of legislation, the criteria is not about historical accuracy, but rather about making students feel uncomfortable, when in fact, we know which groups of students matter here, because for decades, students of color felt uncomfortable about the kind of white supremacist histories they were getting taught in school, but the legislature didn't seem to care much about that.
How could our listeners find out more information about your organization and possibly get involved?
So yeah, we do have a website, refusingtoforget.org, which presents information both about the historical events that we are devoted to commemorating. We have some curricular materials up there. We have links to press coverage, both of our events. We have links to information about the monuments that we've been able to put up. We would love to develop a traveling version of this exhibit. We are looking at the marker landscape and thinking about potential future markers. We're looking for future collaborations with teachers to give them the tools to teach these kinds of histories. And then particularly 2023 is claimed as the bicentennial of the Texas Ranger Force. One of the most upsetting things about this whole question of historical memory is that there is an institution devoted to the study of the Texas Ranger Force, the Texas Ranger Hall of Fame and Museum in Waco. While they are reconsidering their exhibits, we are told, it is nonetheless deeply concerning, if not appalling, that they continue to list as heroes some of the Rangers involved in these atrocities, including the Ranger Captain Frank Hamer, who threatened to kill J.T. Canales for attacking the Ranger Force, and a number of people who were essentially slave catchers in the 1840s and 1850s. So we don't intend for that bicentennial to just be an uncritical celebration of the Rangers.
I really appreciate your joining us and enlightening us about history and about your own efforts to make sure that it's not forgotten. So thank you so much for joining us here today.
Yeah, thanks so much for the invitation.
Thanks. Also, just a reminder, we're also on Facebook and on Twitter.
Well, once again, it's Friday afternoon, and we're speaking with Austin Sanders, staff writer at the Austin Chronicle. How's life, Austin?
It's not too bad. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. It's been a couple of weeks. You've got something in the current issue about EMS employees.
Yeah, so they're kind of in the middle of renegotiating their meet and confer agreement with the city of Austin. Basically, EMS Association, the union that represents EMS workers, is bargaining with the city of Austin on a new labor contract. They go for 4 years. Theirs will expire next year, so they're trying to kind of hammer it out before then. Not only is the department, you know, in the middle of these labor talks, they're also in the middle of looking for a new chief to lead the department. Ernesto Rodriguez, a longtime Austin EMS employee who led the department for 13 years, retired in May. and his chief of staff, Jasper Brown, has been serving as interim chief. But I mentioned the winter storm because that is one of the big precipitating factors, that and just the pandemic, that has been a huge drain on medics in Austin. You know, they have been on the front lines of both of those really unprecedented public health and public safety disasters. The workforce is really experiencing some intense burnout and really kind of places the department at a pivotal moment in its future, right? The next leader is going to really determine what direction the department heads in. It's kind of undergoing a similar reimagining in the way that the police department is. And of course, the labor contract, the big demand from the union is better wages. It's about a $7 per hour increase to the base pay rate from $19 an hour to about 26 or so, and then kind of a proportional raise for people who've been promoted. That's, of course, the big ask for all of the hard work that medics do. It's really draining work. They're asking for that pay raise. The labor contract negotiations are still being played out. And actually, interestingly, I think this is the first time this has happened, but the city is live streaming them on YouTube. So any listeners want to check that out, you can find a link to watch. I mean, it's just people sitting around at a table talking about a contract. So it's not the most thrilling viewing, but it's kind of interesting to be able to watch these negotiations. And basically, the union's argument is it's very expensive to live in Austin. Most medics don't live in Austin because they don't get paid enough. Private ambulance services, like Acadian is one that operates in Austin, they pay more than Austin EMS. Private employers like Amazon, Tesla, they actually employ paramedics in their factories and warehouse and fulfillment centers that pay greater than Austin EMS. And, you know, one of the big kind of attractions to municipal service working in government is the pension, right? You know, government employees typically have a pretty stable retirement, pretty achievable. That is kind of out of reach for some medics now, because in 2012, the length of service requirement was raised from 23 years to 30 years. It's pretty hard work, you know, to stay working as a paramedic, you know, physically demanding work, exhausting mentally and psychologically. To do that for 30 years to achieve full retirement, it's kind of out of the reach for many medics, especially some who are kind of coming to this field as a second career, which is not uncommon. So the medics are kind of feeling like we don't have as great a retirement to look forward to as we once did, as our, you know, predecessors did. So we're really hoping the city will come back and meet us on these pay and benefit increases we're looking for. Of course, the city, they're not really talking to the media the way that the union is, but they told me in a statement, you know, they respect all public service employees and really want to be able to fulfill these asks in the contract. But the budget staff is looking at a pretty big budget deficits in the next few budget cycles, mostly from, you know, limitations imposed by the Texas legislature on how much tax revenue cities and counties can generate. But also, we voters approved Project Connect, $7 billion infrastructure package that the city is going to have to start servicing those bonds soon, start paying those fees. And that's going to be pretty expensive. So there's a number of factors that have the city's budget staff kind of worried about the financial future of the city. And so they're kind of, you know, considering all of these factors as they look at what kind of pay increase they can offer. One other complicating factor is the other two public safety organizations, Austin Fire and Police, they also have to renegotiate their labor contracts, but that's not going to happen until next year. But obviously, the labor office, the budget staff, they're looking ahead to those negotiations to say, hey, the police, they feel like they're in a pretty tough spot right now. They have a huge staffing shortage. They're likely going to want to ask for a big pay increase as well. So these are all factors that the city is having to weigh as they negotiate with the EMS union.
Do we have any sense about when this is all going to wrap up?
Yeah, well, the contract doesn't expire until next year. I think in the fall of next year, but both sides are hoping to have an agreement reached in March, because if the current contract expires without a new one in place, then they kind of go to impasse and the EMS workers would not have a contract, so they would lose out on some pay and benefits. And from the city's perspective, they really want to have this agency done before they move on to police and fire. So I think March is kind of where things are targeting. Most of the agreements have been kind of verbally agreed to. They had just gotten started on the pay and benefits piece, which of course is going to be the most controversial, the most complicated. City staff has indicated they won't come back with a counter offer until sometime in January.
Well, we certainly wish them the best. As you point out, in this reimagined environment that we hope for, I think EMS is going to play an even greater role.
You know, at least among fire and EMS, EMS definitely would play a larger role in the reimagining public safety effort, you know, through this community health paramedics program that they offer. They do a lot of social work or adjacent social work. They are, you know, a big piece of that puzzle.
Well, I think that's all we've got time for today. As always, a real pleasure to speak with you again, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, same. Thanks for having me on, Bob. I always appreciate it.
Up next on coop.org and on the 91.7 HD3 channel, stay tuned for Youth Spin. That's all from us this evening. Stay safe, everyone.